Welcome to Valley Voices, where we bring you conversations covering all things local, from news, politics, and government to culture and community issues that are relevant to Lehigh Valley residents. I'm your host, Margaret McConnell, the executive director here at WDIY. In this episode, I will be speaking with Josh Siegel, the newly elected Lehigh County executive. Josh most recently served in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, and before that, you were also on Allentown City Council.
Yes.
Great. So welcome.
Thank
and
you.
Congratulations on this new role.
Thank you very much.
Coming out of the House and going into a more focused.
Uh-huh.
Is that an accurate way?
One of one, not one of 203.
Yeah.
So it's very different dynamic when you're the sort of the boss, the head of the organization, as opposed to kind of one of many.
Yeah.
And taking your cue from the governor.
Yes. So. And what made you want to get out of that one of many and refocus your political career locally?
Yeah, I think they're just two different roles. I mean, I loved being a legislator. Don't get me wrong. We have a very great legislative delegation. Awesome colleagues. Shout out to Pete and Mike and Nick Miller. We've got a great legislative delegation. Jeannie McNeil, Bob Freeman, Steve Samuelson, who are fantastic at what they do. I think different personalities kind of fit to different roles. I loved the policy work of being a legislator. I love the consensus building. But what I enjoy most in I think, government and policy and work is the ability to, like, set the table and set the agenda.
Mm.
And you can't do that as a legislator. Mm. You know, so much of what we do in Harrisburg is kind of built around what the governor proposes. And
mm-hmm.
so everything starts at the budget address, which I was just at last week. Always exciting. But, like, from there, you have very kind of minimal room to tinker. So you're really kind of taking your cues from the executive, as you should, right? Like, they're in charge of the state in this case. And so what really attracted me to executive was the idea that, like, that is the power, to be candid, is the ability to set the table, steer an agenda, and come up with the strategy. You determine what the direction needs to be, and then you build that coalition of legislators, in this case, county commissioners, around it. And so I think I've always sort of, like, personality-wise, like, been more of an executive, a go-getter, sort of like, hurry up, let's get things done.
Mm.
So.
Yeah, I can relate to that.
I get restless.
It's hard being a cog in the wheel and just waiting for other things to happen
that you have
no control over.
Not fun.
Yeah, I totally get that. Okay, so talk about your vision for Lehigh County and how that differs or may differ from your predecessor.
Yeah, I mean, look, I have a really active and sort of aggressive vision of, like, what government is capable of and what it should do. There's a social contract, right? And so I think for a very long time, we've upheld our end of the bargain as citizens, as residents. Like, we go to work, we pay our taxes, we do our job, we take care of our families. And government, in my opinion, is supposed to be there to have your back. And I don't know that we've always honored that social contract on the public sector side as strong as we should have and can. I really believe that, like, we have an incredible opportunity here in the Lehigh Valley and in Lehigh County to continue to build on our momentum, but also, like, tackle a lot of the challenges that are causing instability and uncertainty in people's lives. We are really lucky in the Lehigh Valley that we've had really great local leadership over the years who made decisions in the past kind of put us to be where we are here today, like, great quality of life, really vibrant cities, like, incredible school districts, good jobs. Like, we are a growing region in a state that's shrinking. So, like, I don't take that for granted. Like, we are in a place most places in Pennsylvania would frankly envy.
Mm.
And so I really, really believe, like, what we need to do in this administration, the next generation of leaders in Lehigh County, is to make sure we don't lose our momentum. It's to now kind of what I like to call address the symptoms of success.
Mm.
Rising cost of living. Everybody wants to be here. So we got a housing crisis, you know, the things that make it hard for us to succeed, transportation, childcare, the things that keep us from, like, you know, accessing our full potential and, you know, doing what we want to do, getting to work.
Mm.
And then really just making sure we don't lose the things that make the Lehigh Valley special, which is that quality of life, that sense of place, that sense of community, investing in the things that make this a great place to live and to raise a family. I really think this is an exciting opportunity because the decisions we make in the next, you know, 48 years during my administration, I think set the table for the next 50.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really exciting opportunity when you can make generational impacts with the decisions you're making. This is not a moment for, like, hold the ship steady and just kind of keep doing steady as it goes.
Right. And you're relatively young.
I would say, yeah.
We don't have to talk age. We don't do that. But I know that you're younger on the younger side.
Yes.
And so you're actually going to get to see some of this stuff play out over the next couple generations.
Yeah. Well, I think that's always sort of been why I think it's important to always have a new generation of leadership. Like, in my opinion, you want folks who are going to live with the consequences of the decisions that they make. I think that's meaningful. I think when you are younger, you have a sense of urgency around the world you're going to inherit. Whereas I think folks who are kind of, you know, at the twilight of either their career, like are more risk averse or more willing to basically say, well, I don't, you know, the horizon for me is much shorter. Yeah. And so I do think, yeah, there's something enticing about being like, you know, a younger executive or just a younger leader in general, is that there is a fierce sense of urgency about fixing what's broken and recognizing that in a lot of ways what we're doing isn't working. And so, like, I think there's a lot less concern or angst around doing things differently or trying things that are new. Mm-hmm. But it is really that, like, sense of urgency. It is that sense of, you know, if we don't make the right decisions now, I have a very long time to live with the consequences of inaction. Mm. And so we should waste no time getting to work.
Right. And that sort of also gives you a kind of check, too, that you're going to have to see the consequences, live with the consequences, just like the rest of us.
So absolutely.
You mentioned a couple of things that you thought were broken, or you alluded to.
Yeah.
What's one thing that you would say you feel is just not working the way it should?
It's definitely the housing crisis. Mm-hmm. You know, I think, like, anyone who lives in the Valley, no matter what side of the ideological spectrum on, no matter where you are, whether you're, you know, working class, you're poor, whether you're, you know, upper middle class, like, it's really tough to find a house in general in the Lehigh Valley. And I think, you know, we've kind of had a very, like, sort of hands-off, laissez-faire approach of whatever happens, happens. We're sort of basically, you know, whatever housing stock naturally and organically occurs, that's sort of like all we kind of have done anything around. And so there's been a more, I will say recently, like, intensive effort to study what else can we do. There's a housing attainability study that Lehigh County paid for. My predecessor, Phil Armstrong, actually invested in. That's going to give us some of the roadmap on how to get out of here. And to be honest, it's like an all of the above approach. Mm. You know, it's going to require the public sector, the nonprofit sector, and the private sector. Like, we're all allies in this space, but it is going to require that sense of urgency. Like, right. I do think we have not done a good enough job building enough housing. It is a supply and demand issue. Mm. It is just that so many people want to live and reside in the Lehigh Valley, and we have not built enough housing stock to accommodate that demand. We know it's about 9,000 units that we're short, and that number grows by like 1,300 every year, so it just keeps exploding. And so, like, for me, that's obviously what we're doing isn't working, and clearly we need a much more aggressive and intentional approach. We certainly need, you know, the government to step up in many ways, because only really we can create a lot of the dynamics and scenarios where you offer, you know, truly affordable housing or, you know, below market rate housing, because we have to either provide the subsidy or the incentive, like, and we have to have that wherewithal to bring folks around the table to make it happen. I think we need to recognize that, like, these things don't happen naturally. They require intentional leadership. They require folks to value and prioritize those things and then execute on the sort of the strategies that make those things happen.
Is this a new thing that you feel like government has to get involved in something like this? Like, in the past, was it the market took care of itself? You know, developers saw where there was opportunity and that's where they built houses. Or do you feel like the government should have, or in this case, Lehigh County should have been involved years ago? And I know that there's been several housing boom needs. Mm-hmm. One of them most recently was COVID and people being able to work from anywhere. And so we saw another influx of people moving into the region.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's not just housing. I think there's a lot of spaces where, like, the public sector has retreated or not been as, like, aggressive a participant as it should be, not as active. Lots of areas where I think we've kind of surrendered our responsibility or maybe not been as enthusiastic about embracing that role. Housing is a great example where historically the government used to be a lot more engaged, certainly like in the past or in the New Deal. And we've kind of stepped away and it was sort of more of a market-based approach. You know, and historically, the only way the government really got involved was through, like, tax credits, like LIHTC, which is really the biggest sort of, like, affordable housing initiative in the last, like, 40, 50 years, happened under Reagan. Hasn't really been any kind of big initiatives or innovations since then. And so what's exciting now is you are watching a lot of local governments and state governments get really creative and start to reassert themselves in that space. And I honestly, I think there's a whole host of areas where, like, the government has a bigger role to play, you know, child care, retirement security. A lot of areas where, frankly, like, the market can't in and of itself kind of meet the demand or isn't suitable in every potential scenario. There's a lot of areas where, like, we do need to unleash the power of the market. We need to make it easier to build. We need to build more market rate housing so there's less competition bidding downward on, like, traditionally affordable housing. But, like, there was always going to be a role for the public sector to play because we are the one entity, frankly, that sole interest is entirely people and principle and not profit, not, you know, maximizing dollars, not maximizing, you know, your profit incentive. And that's why we have to be at the table, because we just have a distinctly different set of goals and values. Not that it's wrong that private sector values profit. That's their job. And
right.
there are ways to channel that and harness that for public good and make sure they're doing what they need to do. But there's always a role for us.
Okay. And now you have a proposal. It's a $100 million housing plan to address yeah. the region's shortage. How will this work, and how will you be working with the municipalities and developers?
Yeah, so I think like the best leadership is always collaborative by nature, and you build consensus. The great thing about the production fund is that it is a revolving loan fund. So once it is, you know, funded generally through debt, like you float a bond, it exists in perpetuity. And I think that's the most important thing, is sustainability and, you know, long-term investments. We want something that's going to persist for years and years and we can build on. Mm-hmm. And the production fund is very simple. The idea is, if you have a $100 million production fund, like the one I've proposed, traditionally when developers go out and they build housing, they have to fill what's called like a capital stack, which is like a hodgepodge of different financing mechanisms. And the biggest one historically when you build housing is private equity. So you go to private equity, as you know, they lend you money. They also have the highest demand for return on investment, like double digits. They want to make a lot of money. They're private equity. Again, nothing necessarily wrong with that, but that means that that is then reflected in the rents that those developers charge. And so when private sector builds housing and that private equity stack is a big part of it, that's why you have, you know, higher market rate rents. It's why apartments are so expensive to build, because they've got to deliver on that ROI to their lenders and their investors. And your production fund, the production fund model, allows us to kind of boot the private equity component out. And then so you finance that project through significantly cheaper lending options. And then at the end of that project, the government actually takes control and ownership of the housing that's been built. So you actually build publicly owned mixed income housing. So what's exciting about that is that you have, you know, doctors and lawyers living next to janitors and school teachers, which is what you want. You don't want concentrated poverty. Mm-hmm. You want folks from very different socioeconomic backgrounds all living in the same building, because that builds community. Mm-hmm. And you don't create those islands or pockets of, you know, disadvantaged folks. And on top of that, the government gets a revenue positive asset. So for the first time, you can build public housing that actually makes money.
Huh.
And that housing is affordable forever in perpetuity, because we own it and we didn't build it with like LIHTC and tax credits that expire.
Oh,
so
okay.
It's very exciting.
Huh, wow.
Yeah.
And so it's remaking the entire housing development projects, we used to call them when I was growing up.
Yeah.
Many of them have been rebuilt, the longstanding, you know, communities here in the Valley already. So it's really taking that older mentality and making it accessible to everybody.
Yeah, well, and there's this unfortunate stigma around public housing, right? Because I think a lot of folks remember housing from the 60s and the 70s.
Yep.
And the one that always comes to mind is like the Cabrini housing in Chicago, right? And so when we think public housing, we historically think of like the slums. We think of like
the
urban poverty, the tenements, these like poorly maintained, poorly managed buildings, you know, peeling paint, rusted roofs. And
safe.
You know, no, terrible. Nobody wants to live in them. And what's exciting is a lot of these mixed income public housing models, they are indistinguishable from like the market rate apartments you see popping up in Bethlehem and Easton and Allentown. They're high quality. They look nice. It's grounded in the principle and belief that I think a lot of folks share, which is like your income shouldn't determine like the quality of the house you or your children live in. Like you should have the exact same decent standard of living, reliable appliances, heating and cooling that anyone else has.
Right.
And that's what's exciting about this model. Is it allows us to build quality public housing that looks nice. It's kind of housing you'd want in your neighborhood.
Right. All right. That's exciting. So let's talk about public safety.
Okay.
So you've emphasized strong, safe, secure communities in your platform. What specific investment or policies will you pursue in these first 12 months?
Yeah, so it's twofold. I think like the best way to approach public safety is both a little bit of prevention. Right. And then, of course, there is that like certainty of punishment. Like you need to make sure that folks who do break the law know they'll be held accountable. So there's a couple things we're working on. One, I'm really interested in partnering with our district attorney on what's called like the focused deterrence model. It's kind of like a carrot and stick approach to public safety. So if you think about the vast majority of folks who commit violent crimes and the folks that are likely to be both victims and perpetrators are generally a very like small percentage of society overall. It's usually less than like a tenth of a percent. Generally speaking, if you talk with local law enforcement and sort of like, you know, social service providers, they'll be able to tell you almost down to the individual who are the folks most likely to be responsible or victims of serious crime. And so what a lot of, you know, cities and counties have experimented with is this focused deterrence model where you partner police, you know, district attorney, the enforcement side of things with the social service side of things. And you actually preemptively target and identify the individuals that are most likely to be those perpetrators and victims. Mm. And you try to break that cycle of violence and poverty. So if you can find the folks that are likely to offend, you can intervene early and you can say, look, you know, we know that you're likely to be a perpetrator. We know that you're in a situation, you know, where you're in the wrong crowd. We want to get you into good housing. We want to attach you to job opportunities. We want to get you out of this dynamic before you make a life-altering decision. And so, like, for example, Baltimore has used this model recently under their mayor, Brandon Scott. And they've seen, like, a 38% reduction in gun violence, serious homicide reductions. So it works really well. You know, it's about emphasizing that law enforcement can both be compassionate and empathetic, and public safety doesn't have to be just, like, locking people up. And then on the other side of that, obviously, is the certainty of punishment, which is the, like, if you do not take advantage of these opportunities, you don't take the olive branch, you don't take the carrot, you will, you know, be held accountable for your actions, which is important. I think people do need to know, like, at the end of the day, if you are making other folks unsafe, like, we're going to hold you accountable for the way that you, you know, conduct yourself.
Right.
And so this focused deterrence model is very, very successful. And I think the county is the right place to house it because we are the social service provider. You know, that is like our core function. A lot of those responsibilities and roles fall under kind of our purview. And the other thing I really want to work with is our after school programs and a lot of our like our Boys and Girls Clubs, because I think one of the most important things we can do is keep kids off the streets, keep them in productive ends, make sure they've got a good social support system. And so investing in violence reduction programs, investing in after school programming is another great way that we can make sure that we're prioritizing public safety, but also taking care of our kids and making sure that we set them off on the right path.
Right. Great. All right. So moving on from that topic, let's talk about economic development. You mentioned transportation topics earlier as really it's a vital condition of health, right? How you get to a job, how you get to the grocery store. But talk a little bit about traffic, infrastructure, all of those things.
Everybody's favorite thing.
Oh, yeah. Well, I
didn't take 22 to get here, so thank God.
Talk a little bit about how you're going to balance growing with some of these other economic or environmental impacts.
Yeah, I think like I'm a urban planning nerd and like a land use nerd. And so I think what gets underappreciated in like how do we prevent traffic and congestion is really the way we build our communities. So it's not just like more funding for public transportation, very important, need to do it. It's not just, you know, infrastructure and bridges and roads and obviously the way we get to and from. But it's really like the types of communities we build determine, frankly, like the kind of consequences we'll live with. And so, like, I think as we're helping and we're working in partnership with a lot of other municipalities, we do really need to focus on building walkable, dense, mixed-use communities that are, you know, amenity-rich, where you have schools and pharmacies and hospitals and parks all in close proximity to each other. And there's really cool, like, models out there, like the state hospital property, for example, in Allentown, which used to be my state house district. Great example of, like, the type of land use we want to encourage. There's going to be office and retail. There's going to be different types of housing, right? So it's not just single family. It's not just multifamily. Like, we need to embrace a variety of housing stocks. And really, like, that missing middle is key. You need duplexes and triplexes and townhomes and the kind of houses we don't really build as much of as we used to. And on top of that, you need to make sure that, like, you're embracing density, which is a scary thing for some folks. But, like, the reality is that we have only so much land left in the Lehigh Valley. Right. And we've got to be really, really, really strategic about how we use it. The county is a big advocate and investor in farmland preservation. We should continue to do that because it actually targets future development into, like, core areas that we want it to be. But we do need to really encourage, like, more state hospital developments, or the town square model in Lower Macungie is really interesting, where the Topgolf is going. That's basically they're creating a main street from scratch. Or if you're familiar with, like, the Promenade Shops.
Yeah.
A developer recently purchased the land from Lehigh right around the Promenade Shops. That's going to become, like, a really beautiful, you know, mixed-use community. I think they're putting in, like, almost like a man-made, like, mini lake at the center of it and, like, a public amphitheater. That is the kind of development I want to champion, we should all champion, because it makes us less reliant on automobiles. It makes it, like, easier for you to get to, you know, you can walk to work, you can walk to your doctor. And the less time you're driving to where you need to be, the less time everyone else who genuinely has to be in their car is like getting stuck on 22 or getting stuck, frankly, like anywhere now.
Right.
I mean, traffic is even bad, you know, on small arterial streets. And I will, you know, candidly admit I sometimes get very bad road rage. I do not like to sit still in a car, as you might imagine. I don't like to sit still anywhere. So I hate getting stuck in a like bumper to bumper traffic on a side road.
Oh, yeah. I'm right with you. All right. So let's talk about, you mentioned that the county government is all about social services. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about some of those homelessness.
Yep.
Support for mental health. These are big things that are happening right now. Addiction treatment.
Yeah.
What other critical human services and what's kind of in your platform for this first year or so around those issues?
I'll tell you the biggest thing we're working on right now, and it's unfortunate and it's actually quite tragic, is the advent of all the workforce requirements and the work requirements in general. SNAP and Medicaid.
And Medicaid, okay.
You know, this was a lot, I'm sure a lot of folks know and some of your listeners know, you know, the OBBB, which is, you know, the big federal reconciliation bill, applied lots of workforce requirements to folks in order to get Medicaid and SNAP. And I know on its face, it sort of sounds sort of logical, if you will, or fair. You know, if you want government benefits, you need to show that you're working. And here's the reality, like 96% of people on Medicaid who get Medicaid are already gainfully employed or working. And the vast majority of other folks have a reasonable exemption. They're retired, you know, they're disabled, they're caring for someone, so they have a dependent. All of those are valid reasons that you don't need to necessarily demonstrate that you're working. So it's a solution in search of a problem. And to be clear, it is by design intended to kick people off. Like,
right.
It is an administrative burden to create savings. That's really what's happening here. And so most of what we do is contingent on Medicaid funding, our MCO, you know, and the providers we work with. They derive almost all their revenue from Medicaid, right? They are reliant on us, quote unquote, sending our clients or our population their way and then, you know, providing the direct reimbursement. And the biggest thing on my radar this year is making sure we protect our neighbors, making sure that we are working with our, you know, our federally qualified health centers, working with the United Way and working with our partners to help our neighbors navigate those workforce requirements. Because the reality is there's a lot of folks who are eligible today who through no fault of their own will be made ineligible tomorrow when those workforce requirements go into place. Mind you, they have the same job, they have the same ailments, they have all the same issues they had the year prior. It's just that we've arbitrarily decided
We're
changing the rules midway through.
Right.
And people will be hurt because of that. And it's a lot. I mean, just to put Medicaid in perspective, in Pennsylvania, it covers 1 in 4 Pennsylvanians, covers 39% of children, and 1 in 3 births is covered by Medicaid.
Wow.
So it's a lot. You know, you're talking almost 40% of all kids in Pennsylvania rely on Medicaid.
Mm.
You know, it's life and death.
Yeah.
I don't know if you just saw, but like 95,000 people have unenrolled from Penny, which is our health insurance exchange. It's our state-run Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
They've disenrolled because the subsidies weren't renewed. So like my job this year is to get people through that crucible and protect my neighbors from being kicked off services they deserve, that they're eligible for, that they should get, as frankly I think is a human right, and make sure they're not booted off that health care.
Okay.
And their SNAP benefits. Make sure they don't lose anything they're entitled to.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you talked also about government being effective, responsive, and ambitious.
Mm-hmm.
What internal changes or innovations in budgeting or performance audits, all the boring stuff, right? So what are you going to focus on?
Well, I will tell you, it's really about bringing a team in, like with anything. Like, yes, I might be the executive, but you're only as strong as the cabinet that surrounds you. Anyone who tells you that like they alone are fixing the problem or like they alone are the one that's going to solely drive change is selling you a whole bunch of lies. I wish I knew everything. I certainly don't. So I built a really good team around me. And I have to say, like, the most important criterion other than like, can you do the job is like your personality dynamic. And do you bring that same sense of urgency and passion? And I will say, like, I am very fortunate and grateful that I have picked a team of folks in my cabinet who reflect that same sense of urgency. And, you know, as I said, when I like was at my swearing in, you know, that the old adage of like, we've always done it this way is no longer going to fly. And every person that I've put in a position of responsibility in my administration knows that that is the motto. We are a yes and go, not no and slow administration. And I don't, you know, I've never enjoyed the, well, we've always done it that way. Or, you know, satisfactory is sufficient. We want to excel. And I think you can't do anything ambitious in government if you don't have a good team around you. Your best laid plans are only as good as the people that implement them.
Yeah. how are you going to navigate kind of being that change agent? I mean, government is kind of known to be
slow
stuck,
and yeah. It's right? been a lot of, I will tell you, a lot of like elbow grease, getting the wheels and the gears turning. It's certainly been a kind of a culture shock for some folks, but. Mm. I will say being an executive, being a leader, being in charge does mean like sometimes you have to be, I don't want to say the bad guy, but you do have to be the bad cop, if you will. And you have to be you do have to be hard, and you do have to be, you know, firm about your expectations. You know, mm. you can't always be popular. You can't always expect to be liked. You can't always expect your decisions to make everyone smile, in the sense that, you know, when you have high expectations and you're encouraging people to do the job they need to do. An expectation is expectation. We get paid by the taxpayers. I take that responsibility very seriously. And I know people are looking for leadership. And so we can't fail. Mm. Too much is at stake in terms of restoring, I think, credibility and faith in institutions.
Mm. And trust in the institutions. It's definitely declined. So we only have a few minutes left. I went very fast. But I want to give you an opportunity, if there's anything else that's kind of top of your priority list this year that you want to either garner support around or just get the community enthused about.
I will say, like, the one thing I think the county has not done a great job at is telling its own story, being a communicator in its own right. And, you know, as we sit here in local media, we know how hard journalism and media is struggling in general. Funding cuts have made it, you know, hard, you know, led to staff shortages. So I will say, like, government has to become its own best advocate. And I think communication is a two-way street. And honestly, the best way I can reach my constituents and I can reach the county and talk about what I'm doing is, like, build our own ability to communicate. So I think in a very short time, you're going to see the county really build up a very, like, robust communications platform. You're going to see us on Instagram. You're going to see us on TikTok. You're going to see us creating, engaging, and captivating content that I hope pulls people in and creates that two-way conversation. You're going to see me. You're going to see our folks, like, on social media, out at events, engaging with people, trying to create that two-way conversation, but also trying to show we're a $500 million bureaucracy. We spend a lot of money. Spend $2.5 million every day in Medicaid funding. You're going to see the value of the services you provide, because we're going to let people know just how many lives we interact with and how many lives we make a difference in. Mm. We have not always been good at that. But what I do want to encourage all your listeners to do, and anybody listening, is when those platforms exist, when you start to see those pages materialize, follow us, engage with us, help share it. Because I will be honest, like, it scares me that there's going to come a day where you do a press release and, frankly, nobody responds and nobody writes about it. We have no choice. Like, out of necessity, we have to go tell our own story. Because I hear all the time, like, government doesn't do anything, or, you know, what does the government do? And I want people to appreciate the services we provide and the employees and the work that they do. Every time we help somebody with mental health or addiction, I want to tell the story of that provider, the person providing the service, and, frankly, the people whose lives we're changing, because it will make people see the value of every dollar we spend. Mm. And that's the most important thing, is making a proactive case for how important government is and why it matters and why it's worth investing in and sustaining and expanding.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. I'm not supposed to editorialize, but I'm actually not a journalist, so it's okay. But it's true. You don't really know what are you paying your taxes for? What are the services? Unless you need a service, you don't know that service is being provided and why it's important to the greater community at large.
And even if you don't use the service, I think we all have empathy and compassion. And I think we can see the value of providing the service, even if we don't need that service at that point in time. Knowing my tax dollars help somebody get up on their feet when they've fallen down, I'm willing to pay for that. I think a lot of people are.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to reading all about all the things and seeing all the things that you're going to be doing, and want to thank you again. We've been talking with Josh Siegel. He is the new county executive for Lehigh County. You've been listening to Valley Voices here on WDIY. You can always listen again at our website, wdiy.org. You can download our free app or anywhere you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for being here.